The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Maya Wollner, your podcast host. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Benoît Majerus about his recent book, From the Middle Ages to Today, Experiences and Representations of Madness in Paris, published in France under the title Du Moyen Âge à nos jours, Expériences et Représentations de la Folie à Paris by Périgame Press in 2018. Benoît Majerus is Associate Professor of European History at the University of Luxembourg. His research interests include the social and material history of psychiatry, as well as the history of World War I and World War II. In addition to the book we will be discussing today, he has also written Among the Mad, A Social History of Psychiatry in the 20th Century, also in French and published by the University of Rennes Press in 2013. Good afternoon, Benoît. It's great to have you on New Books in Science.
Thanks for having me, Maya.
So let me start by asking you, what inspired you to write this book?
There are two main reasons for writing the book. The first one is quite simple. It's an editor, Périgame Press, who is specialized in books on Paris, and who several years ago had published a book entitled Crime in Paris, and now wanted something similar on madness. And on my side, after having published the book you mentioned, Among the Mad, which was a classic academic monograph, I wanted to do something that covered a larger period and that also addressed a larger public. So that are the main two reasons for the book.
Elsewhere, you've described the sections of the book as capsules, which give a sort of impressionistic overview of the ways in which the experiences and representations of madness have changed over time. How did you address the question of continuity or rupture in the period that you cover?
So the book is divided in six larger chronological chapters. And for every chapter, there's one clear pitch, so an overarching story. For example, the chapter about the Middle Ages is entitled Madness, but an object that you cannot find. But to tell this larger story, I have then chosen smaller stories that illustrate this pitch. And if the larger story makes sense for the history of Western Europe in general, the examples are more directly linked to the history of Paris, and that's why you sometimes have this impression of a more impressionistic approach, but that is linked that I have to fit my Paris little stories into a larger story that is also valuable for other parts of Europe.
And why did you decide to select Paris as your geographical focus? And maybe you can also address the idea of madness that we sometimes have as a sort of specifically urban problem or a problem of civilization.
Again, there's a very pragmatic answer. Périgame, the editor, published this book about Paris. But then there's also a second answer that is perhaps more stimulating on the intellectual level, is that Paris is a very interesting standpoint for an historian to observe the history of madness over time. And this is for one major reason. The city has been from the Middle Ages on a place where political, religious, economic, intellectual elites are heavily present, and all these people are writing. And so if there are written sources, a historian can tell a story. And you have written sources on madness from the 10th century on, which is very early. And what is also interesting is that this production of sources never stopped till today. So for other places in Europe, you have more sources, but only for, let's say, the 15th century or the 18th century or something in the 9th century. But what is interesting in Paris is that you have this continuity of sources from the Middle Ages on. And then as Paris is also an important political center, all this form of marginality, so not only madness, was heavily controlled. And so you have from very early on institutions that enclose madmen, not only madmen, so you don't have in already this specialization, you know, in the 19th century, but you have institutions that enclose marginality. And again, these institutions produce written sources, but also material sources that allows, again, new insight in how society managed madness. And then a last interesting point is that what you mentioned is that from the 19th century on, madness is closely connected to the city. So what is interesting in the Middle Ages, madness is more linked to a rural society, to root and not to the city. And so, for example, when the king is mad, he's coming to the city to calm down. And that's something for us today, it seems evident that it is the city that produces madness and that is a pathogenic environment. And so for the last chapter, this question of does the city produce madness and how does the city produce madness and why does the city produce madness is also very, very present.
In your research, how did you overcome the problem of retrospective diagnosis?
I would say that that's a question I'm not so much interested in. Today, most historians would argue that retrospective diagnosis is not an historical question. I think that psychiatric diagnosis always makes sense in a specific historical context, and trying to apply diagnosis from today to a former historical period seems problematic to me for two reasons. First, it in a certain way deconstructs the diagnosis from today by applying it to the past. And secondly, it applies a concept to a period where it does not make sense for the contemporaries and is therefore anachronistic. And saying that someone is schizophrenic in the 17th century by this retrospective diagnosis doesn't help me to understand what is happening in the 17th century. So I think that most of the historians today no longer are interested in this question of retrospective diagnosis.
So I was really taken by the images that you included in the book, which to me are sort of a mixture of captivating, disturbing, mundane, and artistic. To let the readers know what they range from, there include maps, architectural drawings, religious images, photographs, administrative charts, and beyond. And so maybe you could tell me, why did you feel it was important to include such a wide range of images? And what motivations ultimately influenced how you selected the images that you wanted to use?
So that was, for me, till now I've only written books and articles where sometimes there was one or two image, and mostly illustrate something, but never that it was really part of the narrative. And so choosing the illustrations was one of the most fascinating tasks in making the book. And the reason for this presence of images are manifold. Again, Paragram is an editor that really values illustrations and really puts energy and time in integrating them into a text. And into a text, so they are part of the story you tell. It's not only to illustrate the text, but they tell their own story. A second important point is perhaps the distinction between the maps and the other illustrations, because the maps were produced specifically for the book. So they are in a certain way my interpretation of the past, such as the text. And the other images are primary sources produced by contemporaries and allows me and also the readers to see which sense the contemporaries gave to madness. And today, as I say, when you use images, you are often motivated by two reasons. First, there's this general idea, which is perhaps not completely right, but that's the general idea, that books for a larger public should contain images because it makes the book more attractive. But images, as for the historians or as sources, make also sense for two reasons, or for me. For centuries, most of the people were not able to read text. So, for example, images in churches were the way how the world was explained to them. So it was a very visual culture. And I think that this importance of the visual culture is not only true for Middle Ages and early modern times, where people were not able to read, but it's still, or is again, valuable today. You know, we look perhaps more at Instagram, or we spend more time with Instagram than with long text. And secondly, images also offer a concentration of interpretation, and sometimes tell a story more effectively than several lines of text. So choosing the images took at least as much time as writing the text, because the challenge was to find new images. If you look at books on madness, you always find the same images, often people with suede jackets, or you have these very classical images of Charcot and the hysteric woman in the Salpêtrière. So the goal was to find for every period new images that have not already been reproduced in other books. It was also important to find images that tell a story, so not just to take a picture of a famous psychiatrist. You can take one, but there's no sense in taking 20, because that's not telling a story. And then a last thing that I find interesting is that when I was looking for all these images, I also experienced how much the digitalization of primary sources has completely changed the way we do research today. Especially for the Middle Ages and the early modern times, we have today a very large corpus of sources that are available online. And even for the 19th and the 20th century, on the beginning of the 20th century, numerous newspapers and magazines are today available online and are very easy to find thanks to Gallica. So the French one have a very centralized platform of digitized sources. And so you can also, you have a very large source corpus where you can look into, and that was also very fascinating.
I have to say, I really found the selection of images very successful, and I was impressed actually with the novelty of the images that you included. So I think that was very well done. Since you mentioned maps, I think I'll jump ahead to a question that I wanted to also ask you, which is about maps and how they figure as such important iconographic documents within your book. There are a number of them, but maybe you can select one that you think is particularly important and speak about it in greater detail and explain how it provides important information about the experience or representation of mental illness.
So the maps are in this book in part because I'm a little bit jealous of geographers who can always use this map, and also because Paragram, so the editor, has a real competence in map, and so I was happy to work with them together. They have people that are doing nothing else than maps the whole day, and so for me it was also an experiment. Which stories can you tell with maps? And so there are several ones that I really like. One of my favorite ones is the one dedicated to the patients of the Seine Department. So Paris is in a larger administration that is called the Seine Department in 1914, so just before the World War I broke out. And this department, the Seine Department, so Paris had a lot of asylums that were managed by themselves, one inside Paris and several around Paris. But the majority of the inmates that came from Paris were spread to France, and mainly for economic reasons. So if you put an inmate into a Paris asylum in the end of 19th century, you had to pay 2.5 francs. And if you put it in a provincial asylum, you had only to pay 1.2 francs. So for economic reason, they put a lot of inmates in outside of Paris. And when you put it on a map, you see that more than half of the population was outside of Paris. And then all the question of the links you still can have with your friends or with your family appears in a completely different representation. If you read it, you say, okay, that must be difficult if your cousin is, for example, in Clermont-Ferrand and not in Paris, where his family lives or his friend lives. But if you see it on a map, it, or at least for me, it became far more evident. And especially if you see it on the map and you see how many people, so the bigger the circle is, the more people were in this French department. And when you see then how many big circles are outside and very far outside of Paris, you really see the difficulties of this idea of keeping touch with family or friends. And you know that the only way to get out, or often the only way to get out of an asylum, was that family or friends were again ready to take you back. And if you are like 200 or 300 kilometers away from them, it's very difficult to keep this contact. So that is one of the maps which I really liked.
That's really fascinating. Let's get a little bit into the chapters now. In chapter one, you spend some time speaking about the figure of the court jester in the Middle Ages. The translation into English loses the reference to insanity that the French term has, le fou du roi, or the fool of the king. What does this figure reveal to us about the history of madness in the Middle Ages?
So, le fou du roi, so I always stay with the French word, illustrates perfectly the complicated story of madness in the Middle Ages, where it is not clearly defined as a topic neither by religious clergymen nor by physicians. So it's something that is not well defined, as in the early modern times. And so the images we have about the Middle Ages are also very much influenced by the 19th century, where stories on the Middle Ages became again very popular. Let's just think about Victor Hugo's Notre Dame, where La Fête des Fous is a central element, and that, which later become then also a central element in some Disney films. And so the Fou du Roi was a person, and it's not clearly defined if he's really mad, but a person that is different, that lived at the court in order to entertain the king or the queen or the prince or a bishop or a rich merchant. And so they were there to entertain and to make law. And the French historian Bernard Guenet described them as petit humain de compagnie, so as house pets in a certain way. So they were there like today we use animals. One of the functions of men could be, or was at that time, as a house pet, so to entertain and to make law.
In chapter two, you include an 1866 wood carving by Charles Larure, which depicts an episode of the Convulsionaries of Saint-Médard, dating from the 1720s and 1730s. Why was this event still memorable over 100 years later?
So yeah, I will first explain what the Convulsionnaire was. So it was a religious movement from the beginning of the 18th century where some members, not everybody, experienced convulsions. And it was very present in Paris. And at that time, France was in a political and religious upheaval. And so through this movement of Convulsionnaire, several religious, theological, but also political topics were heavily discussed. And what is especially interesting for the historian of madness is that this movement printed several stories of people that experienced these convulsions. And so it's for the first time that the historian has a larger corpus of archives that gives us access to the voices of the madmen. So beforehand, and even today, often our sources are more written, they are written on the madmen by physicians or by priests or by nurses, but seldom they are written by the madman himself. And what is interesting here is that we have already in the 18th century that the voices of these madmen are printed. What is also interesting is that later on, so in the 19th and the 20th century, the Convulsionnaire proved to be a fascinating group for the experts of madness. So, for example, psychiatrists working on hysteria in the end of the 19th century described these Convulsionnaires as forerunners of the hysteric women. So they did this retrospective diagnosis. And they found that these hysteric women had the same or similar experience than the Convulsionnaire. And then what is interesting, in the 20th century, the psychoanalyst again did a retrospective diagnosis by saying that this Convulsionnaire were the typical example of people that repressed their feelings.
That's really fascinating. So what were some of the ways in which revolutionary madness was constructed in images during the 19th century?
Yeah, so that was a very interesting topic to write about. In a certain way, you can interpret large part of the history of the 19th century as a way of restoring the order that has been severely disturbed by the French Revolution and all the other revolutions that follow in the 19th century. And so saying that the revolutionaries were mad was a way to disqualify them. So you could say, okay, that was madness and we should go back to an order of the 18th century. And for example, and then you have one of the examples, Thérèse de Méricourt, who was one of the few revolutionary women. She was also described as mad as someone who was in favor of the revolution, but also mad that a woman should never go into politics. And so there was a whole narrative of arguing that that the only people that were in favor of revolution were mad people. And at the same time, you had also a narrative saying that revolution made people crazy. And so a lot of psychiatrists were writing books in the 19th century trying to demonstrate how after revolutionary events one could observe peaks of madness. And again, that was an argument saying, okay, revolution is bad because revolution produced madness. So in both way, in both narratives, the link between madness and revolution was a way to discredit revolution.
In chapter 4, you have a capsule entitled One Psychiatry at Two Speeds. Can you explain this section a little bit further for our listeners?
Yeah, so this chapter tries to show that inside psychiatric institutions, class is one of the fundamental markers. It's not so much about diagnosis, it's a lot about gender, and it's a lot about class. So the typical image we have about asylums are these very large asylums, but they were mostly for poor inmates that could not pay for medical care. And inside these large asylums, conditions were very poor, and these large institutions and the name of asylum were afflicted with stigma. But beside this, and in France, it's mainly state psychiatry, existed a network of private, smaller institutions. And they were designed for families with money that wanted their family members in settings that resembled the bourgeois family life. So these institutions were built in green surroundings of Paris, often accessible by tramways. You had pianos, you had libraries. So it was in a certain way a copy of the environment where the people were coming from, and they were not called asylums, but maison de santé ou sanatorium ou clinique neurologique. And the advertisements for these institutions did not use the words of madness, but spoke rather of nervousness. So you had at a certain way two psychiatry. You had the psychiatry for the poor, and then you had a psychiatry for the rich. And I think that's a very, very important narrative when you're speaking on psychiatry in the 19th and the 20th century.
Yeah, I do have to say that the images of les maisons de santé look rather luxurious, actually.
Yeah, but there were really people, they had the money to pay, and it was really a copy. So it was to reproduce the bourgeois environment these people know from their home.
So throughout your book, you also include images of advertisements for psychiatric drugs. What can we learn about the tensions between the experience of mental illness and its representation by comparing, for example, these advertisements for psychopharmaceuticals and then patient accounts of taking these drugs? Did the patients experience the so-called psychopharmaceutical revolution as such?
Yeah, that was one part of the book where I've also done a lot of research. So the introduction of phenoleptics is certainly one of the most researched topics on the history of psychiatry in the 20th century. And for a long time, historians reproduced the narrative of some of the psychiatrists who defined this introduction of neuroleptics as a therapeutic revolution. But in the last 10 years, this narrative has become more complex for several reasons. First, the history of psychiatric drugs and biological therapies did not start with neuroleptics. So today there are a lot of research done on drugs that were already used in the 19th century, and you see that these drugs were already used on a massive level in asylums. and from the 1920s on, several other biological therapies that were also defined as revolutionaries, as revolutions, were already inside the asylum, be it the insulin therapy, the electroshock therapy, or lobotomy. Today, these therapies are like are no longer or are less used, but at that time, they were considered as also as revolution. Second point that makes the narrative more complex is that not all psychiatrists did share the enthusiasm of their colleagues. For some, neuroleptics did not work or did not work better than other therapies. And Saint Anne, which is the major psychiatric hospital in Paris where the neuroleptics were invented, some psychiatrists remained opposed to the new drugs for several years. And other psychiatrists were very skeptical because they said that neuroleptics sedated the patients too much and defined neuroleptics as chemical lobotomy. And then finally, in historiography, there has been a real interest in the voices of the patients in the last 10, 20 years. And that has also changed the narrative because some patients welcome the new drug, and when they get the new drug, they say, "Oh, we are finally cared for, and there's finally a therapy." But there are also other patients that complain about the drugs, about the side effects, about being too sleepy, about having skin problems. So, in general, like always, when you have a broader picture, when you're not talking only about the two or three famous psychiatrists, but if you integrate normal psychiatrists or not famous psychiatrists, if you include nurses, if you include patients into your narrative, and so also at the sources you are looking at, the story becomes far more complex.
So what about works of representation produced by patients themselves? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the first International Congress of Psychiatry and the patient artworks that were put on display.
And so very quickly after the Second World War, some French psychiatrists launched the idea of an international Congress of Psychiatry. And in 1915, psychiatrists from around the world, with the exception of the communist bloc, gathered in Paris. And as it was usual at that time and still today, a social program was organized for the participants. And among other events, an exposition with patient artwork was put up. And artistic works by patients had already interested some psychiatrists from the end of the 19th century on. But you have really a change in the interview period, and then really after World War II. And so this exhibition that resembled about 300 works of art greatly contributed to the legitimization of what is called today art brut, and which is today completely integrated into the art market. And it's still today, on the other hand, a very difficult topic, there's still a discussion going on. Has it only a therapeutic function? So making people work and express their feelings, or is there a real artistic inspiration behind this art? But so this first International Congress of Psychiatry and the exposition that went along with this congress was a very important moment of legitimization of this art.
Did the physicians by chance use the images as a way also to diagnose? Do you know anything about that?
So there has been some projects on that. In Paris in the 60s, they tried to computerize all these images. So they had a huge data bank in order to see, okay, does people that have schizophrenia paint other in another way than people that are depressed? So there has been a lot of especially the 60s and the 70s trying to use it as a diagnostical tool. I think that today it's no longer used in a systematic way to establish diagnosis. It's more used at one hand as a therapy and then on the other hand, it's also for some, it's a real field of art, and then it goes in other direction. Then it's in museums, it's sold.
So how has the power of representation been harnessed by the anti-psychiatric movement and also the Mad Pride movement?
Yeah, what is important about these two movements that start in the 60s is that for the first time, there was already a similar movement at the end of the 19th century, but you have now from the 60s on a very regular and systematic way, not longer only psychiatrists or nurses that are talking about madness and that in a certain way say we are legitimate to talk about madness, but you have also patients. And these patients, they try to invent new language to talk about it. So, for example, they call themselves no longer patients, but for example, survivors. So that's one part. And then on the other hand, they also sometimes do a reappropriation of language and trying to redefine words that have a negative connotation into something positive. And that's typical of this Mad Pride movement, where they use for themselves the name or the word of mad and say, okay, we are pride of being mad, and being mad is something you can be pride of. And then they try to change the signification of the name. And that's something where they, in a certain way, took that over from the Black Power movement, where also Black was considered for a long time as something negative, and then it was in a certain way retransformed in something positive. And that's also something, if you work on the history of psychiatry, what is interesting is that the anti-psychiatric movement or the MAP movement are not happening outside of society. They are not only part of the history of psychiatry, but they are also part of the history of society. And so there are clear links to other social movements, such as the Black Power movement or the gay movement, where they overtook the same manner of slogans of going into the streets. So that's also a very interesting point where you link the history of psychiatry to other histories.
I noticed that you included an image from the Mad Pride parade in Paris in 2014, which features a photograph, again, of an individual dressed as a court jester. So there is also another example of a reappropriation of an image that we've already discussed today. So we're sort of at the last question that I wanted to ask you, which is how I end all of my interviews. And I wanted to know, what was the most surprising or unusual discovery that you made while conducting research for this work?
So I really liked writing the chapter on kleptomanie, which was a diagnosis for bourgeois women that were stealing inside the new large Grand Magasin in Paris in the second half of the 19th century. And it was in a certain way not possible that they did it when they went for the society at that point. It was, they could not imagine why bourgeois women would steal something. And so they had to invent a madness for them. And it was called kleptomanie. But for me, the most interesting discovery was the existence of a group of patients in the 60s in France, which is called méchants handicapés, which I find already a very funny name. So I don't know how you would translate that in English. Méchant, how do you translate that in English?
Well, do you mean mad people? Méchant,
how do you...
Those who are angry, maybe?
But it's also that they are not nice, you know? Méchant is also meaning not nice, so it's like the not nice handicapped, and I really like this this name, which is very radical in a certain way, you know, and what is interesting is that the history of this group is largely unknown, and they have a very interesting, they published a very interesting magazine where they had very radical demands of what it would mean for them to be integrated into society. And so I really liked the name of the group and also their way of expressing it in their magazine.
Well, I have to say thank you so much for your time today, Benoit. It was really interesting to speak with you about your book.
Thanks for inviting me.
And thank you to everyone who listens to New Books in Science. I'm Maya Wollner. Until next time.